know it's good for our health to exercise, but can exercise actually slow down the aging process?
Aging is not actually inevitable. Exercise really can reduce the risk of a lot of the diseases we would otherwise get if we didn't exercise, particularly heart disease, diabetes. It's very potent at warding off the diseases that we commonly associate with later life.
That's Judy Foreman. We talk with her about her book, Exercise is Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. It's out from Oxford University Press. Then we talk with Michael Zapata about his acclaimed novel, The Lost Book of Adana Moreau. It's out from Hanover Square Press in February. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Death is, at least so far, inevitable, but probably most of us fear the process of getting there worse than our actual end. It's the deterioration, both mental and physical, that we fear most. And according to my guest, science journalist Judy Foreman, we do have a certain amount of choice over that. In her fascinating new book, Exercise is Medicine, Foreman points out that if we stay active throughout our lifespan, we can actually slow and even reverse our biological age, almost like putting our bodies back in time. Foreman delves into the science behind why exercise is so good for us and why different kinds of exercise, like aerobics and resistance, are good for different reasons. Foreman also tells us how we can tweak our routines to exercise more effectively in less time. In addition to Exercise as Medicine, Judy Foreman is the author of A Nation in Pain, which we spoke with her about in 2014, and The Global Pain Crisis. She was a staff writer and health columnist at the Boston Globe for many years. Judy Foreman, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be back.
So this is just a wonderful book, especially for an exerciser like me, but I think it's a wonderful book for everyone. Exercise is Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. So about aging, actually, because that is a big focus of the book, you actually say that aging is theoretically not inevitable. What do you mean by that?
Well, interestingly, one of the things I found out that was just fascinating was that some creatures on Earth don't actually age, which sort of technically means they have the same risk of dying at any point. Their risk of dying doesn't get greater as the years go by, whereas with us, it's not linear, but in general, we have a bigger risk of dying when we're 90 than when we're 9. That's kind of intuitively obvious to us humans, but not all creatures behave that way. Some creatures really don't age, which means that aging, which essentially means falling apart, the deterioration of more or less every part of our body, is not actually inevitable. In fact, demographers, people who study populations, are scientists who think that with exercise, we could do what they call squaring the curve. And that means instead of what we have now, which is after a certain point in life, your 60s or 70s, you start this sort of long, slow, miserable, gradual decline with more and more disability and dysfunction and disease. Instead of that, we could square the curve, which means staying at a pretty high level, nice, flat, horizontal line with a fair amount of health and not too much disability and disease, and then a sudden, quick, merciful death. Sounds a little brutal, but it's better than the long, slow decline.
I think you use a term, compression of morbidity,
yes.
Being disease.
That's right. That's exactly the term. It's kind of a mouthful, but compression of morbidity just means kind of squeezing all the bad stuff into a very short amount of time before death, instead of having a long drip, drip, drip of bad stuff for many years.
And are you also saying that exercise can extend the lifespan as well as our span of good health?
Yes, exactly. It extends both the lifespan and the health span. And it partly extends the lifespan because it extends the health span. Yes, I mean, exercise really can reduce the risk of a lot of the diseases we would otherwise get if we didn't exercise, particularly heart disease, diabetes. It's very potent at warding off the diseases that we commonly associate with later life.
Yes, and this book is absolutely fascinating in how it goes into the science of how exercise does that. But before we get to that, I'm a grandmother.
Me too.
And I just love this grandmother effect that you talk about as one explanation as to why we don't die right after we reproduce like some creatures do.
Yes, well, of course, evolution didn't plan it this way because evolution doesn't plan anything. But there seems to be an evolutionary advantage to having grandmothers around. And this is true not just for humans, but for whales and elephants and other mammals that have, you know, extended lifespans for females after menopause. And you wonder, okay, why don't these females and males to some extent not just die after they've passed on their genes? Well, it turns out, like with elephants and whales, they often know where the feeding spots are, which is useful in terms of if the tribe is facing starvation. With elephants, they can remember, that the matriarchs can remember where old water holes are if there's a drought. And with humans, we pass on our knowledge, but also our money and other things that benefit our children and our children's children. And if you have time, I have a cute little illustrative story of how I observed this grandfather and grandmother effect myself. Would you like to hear that?
Absolutely.
So back in 1993, I was a science reporter for the Boston Globe, and I went out to New Mexico to the Navajo Reservation, where there was a big epidemic going on that unfortunately the press had dubbed the Navajo flu, which was kind of pejorative. But what it actually was an epidemic of a virus called the Hanta virus, H-A-N-T-A. And the New Mexico health officials and doctors from the CDC, that's the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, were all gathering in New Mexico trying to figure out what was going on because people were getting this horrible pneumonia and dying. And they had the good sense to talk to the Navajo elders, who remembered and told the doctors that twice before in the 20th century, they had observed times when there was a lot of rainfall and melting snow and a big bumper crop of trees, pinon trees that made the pine nuts. And also because of the excess pine nuts, a bumper crop of deer mice. And the deer mice population, of course, pooped. And the poop would dry and become aerosolized. And then the people would breathe it and get these horrible lung infections. So the Navajos, these elders, the grandfathers and grandmothers, essentially, were able to give information to the scientists that was really useful in stopping the epidemic. So again, that's a case of the grandmother effect or the grandfather effect, really helping the whole tribe and indirectly helping their own genes survive. So it is evolutionarily beneficial.
That's a great story.
Isn't that great? Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people say, well, how old you're going to live and how healthy you are really based on genes. But you point out that, you know, we have genes, but we also have this other layer that is determined by environment, the epigenetic layer. What is the connection between exercise and epigenetic factors in how long and how healthily we live?
Well, just to clarify, genes are very important, but so is environment, as you said. It's both nature and nurture. So yeah, animals who grow up in a safe environment, obviously babies born into a safe environment have a better chance of making it to adolescence and adulthood and reproduction. If you're in an unsafe environment, you tend to die in childhood. And you can think of it in terms of vaccinations. One of the main things that has allowed our human life expectancy to increase so dramatically over the last century is childhood vaccinations, because if the babies don't die in infancy or early childhood, they can live to grow up and reproduce. You mentioned epigenetic alterations, and epigenetics, for people who may have forgotten, are factors that act on genes. Genes are in the DNA that act on genes to tell the genes whether to be active or quiet. And so this is not changes in the DNA itself. Those changes would be called mutations. These are changes, factors that act on the DNA to turn a gene on or off. And one of the big epigenetic changes that goes along with aging is a process. It's kind of a mouthful, but it's called DNA methylation. The methyl group is just a bunch of, it's a chemical cluster. And this little cluster, this methyl group, lands on various spots on the DNA in our cells and tells genes to turn on or turn off. And in general, as we get older, there's more and more DNA methylation, which changes the expression of genes. In fact, there was a wonderful experiment in Sweden where they asked a bunch of very healthy young guys, and in this case, they were all guys, to ride a bike, an exercise bike in the gym. They took muscle biopsies, little chunks of muscle tissue to study from both their legs, and at the beginning of the experiment and at the end. And the guys rode the bikes for 45 minutes at a time, 3 or 4 times a week for about 4 months, then another round of muscle biopsies. The big trick was they asked the guys to use only one leg. So they had one leg pumping like crazy and the other leg with the foot flat on the floor. And the DNA methylation pattern, the epigenetic pattern, was totally different in the exercised leg compared to the non-exercised leg. And this was a beautiful, perfect controlled experiment. Same body, same food, same sleep, same work, everything. The only difference was that one leg got exercised and one leg different. In essence, according to the epigenetics, the exercise leg was younger than the non-exercise leg. It showed a younger DNA methylation pattern. So that's very cool and easy to remember.
Oh, that's amazing.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, it's really incredible. So you speak in this book, Judy Foreman, in Exercises Medicine, of 9 cellular and molecular hallmarks of aging. Now, they're kind of a mouthful. I wonder if you could just maybe choose a couple of them that really illustrate the connection between exercise and these molecular hallmarks. And I believe the methylation is one as well that you just pointed to. What are some of the others that you think are a really good example of this?
Yes, you're exactly right. The DNA methylation pattern, that's part of the category that they call epigenetic alterations. I think one of the others that's sort of easy to understand and very dramatic is what happens with aging to these little things called mitochondria. So people may already know or may remember from their high school biology, inside our cells are these little organelles, these little baby organs called mitochondria. And they are the energy-producing factories in our cells. This is what allows us to eat food and breathe in oxygen. And in these mitochondria, the result of combining those two things is energy, specifically a molecule called ATP, which stands for adenosine triphosphate. So that's the job of the mitochondria. And what happens with aging is over time, our mitochondria tend to poop out and be less and less good at creating energy, ATP. Exercise mass produces mitochondria. Exercise allows cells in the muscles that are contracting to make more and more mitochondria, which results in more and more of the energy molecule. And it's like, as with the DNA methylation pattern, the same holds true for mass producing mitochondria. It's only in the muscles that you use. So again, if you rode a bike with just one foot, that leg or that foot would have a lot more mitochondria in those muscle cells than in the leg or foot that didn't get exercise. It's very dramatic. And all this is because of what's happening biochemically inside the muscle cells that you're using.
So what I'm getting a picture of here is that actually there must be a difference then between chronological age and, how do we call it, molecular age?
Yeah, sure. Our physiological age or biological age. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. In fact, there have been a lot of studies of people called centenarians. Those are people aged 100 or older. And that's actually a growing part of the population. And even super centenarians, people who are over 110, that segment is growing as well. It turns out that the genetic pattern and the pattern of DNA methylation, in fact, this epigenetic change, when you look at the centenarians, their DNA methylation pattern looks like that of a much younger person than their chronological age. So, yes, people can actually be, much younger than their number of birthdays would let you think.
Now, you write that exercise is the closest thing that we have as a magic bullet against aging. I wonder if you could talk about what are some of the parameters or guidelines and ways of exercise that impact us that may be better than others. Exercise is a pretty general category. So what kind of exercise are we talking about?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The government guidelines, which were put together by doctors and exercise scientists, call for 150 minutes a week of moderate activity exercise. 150 minutes boils down to 30 minutes a day for just five days. That's not that much, and you can chop it up into segments, and so it doesn't even have to be continuous. And moderate activity, the shorthand definition for that is like walking fast, something you can do and you can still talk through it, but you can't sing through it. In other words, so you can be a little bit out of breath, but not absolutely gasping for air. That is enough to get you a lot of the benefits, especially heart benefits, from exercise. Most exercise studies to date have been focused on aerobic exercise, like walking fast or running or biking or even swimming fast. But there's also growing evidence that weightlifting or pumping iron or resistance training, whatever you want to call it, is also valuable. And you can get your heart rate up doing that, too, if you do it hard enough and fast enough. So there's a whole bunch of different exercise. I've asked a lot of my exercise physiologist sources, what's the best exercise? And they all kind of hedge. I mean, personally, I think probably running and fast walking is certainly the most studied. So people tend to think that's the best. But anything that, dancing, whatever gets your heart rate up, and more important, whatever you like or can try to convince yourself you like, is the exercise that's best for any given person. Because if you hate it, you're not going to do it. But if you like it, or if you can talk yourself into liking it, that would be the best kind for you.
And you also talk about different ways that exercise is good for the body and different than kinds of exercises that are good for them. Like, for example, let's talk about the brain.
Yeah.
You have a wonderful chapter you call Exercise Miracle Grow for the Brain, saying that it improves memory and cognition and can prevent or even slow dementia. So give us a big picture about this, and then what might be some of the best ways, best kinds of exercise to do for that?
I actually have two chapters on the brain because the brain is obviously so important. And that's one of the things people tend to worry the most about. The one chapter, as you said, is on cognition, memory and thinking and our intellectual processes. The other chapter is on mood and exercise as basically an antidepressant and anti-anxiety medication, if you want to think of it this way. Basically, what happens, and this is true in for both mood and cognition, is that when you exercise, your brain, inside your brain, cells pump out a chemical that scientists have called Miracle Grow for the brain. Its technical name is BDNF, which stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And even though that's a mouthful of words, what it really means is it's a factor, a chemical that's brain-derived, made in the brain, neurotrophic. It goes to nerve cells. This BDNF, this Miracle-Gro, goes to a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is the main memory center, and literally causes new brain cells to grow, new neurons. The hippocampus actually grows in size as a result of exercise. I mean, this is incredibly important. And there was one Canadian study from Ontario that found that if everyone who is currently not exercising, not physically active, became active, we could eliminate one in every seven cases of Alzheimer's. That's huge. That's a very powerful effect. And it's there are just the data lining up showing how good exercise is for cognition is very powerful. It's also very powerful for the mood effects. I mean, with a caveat here, if some of your listeners are feeling depressed, I'm suggesting exercise, but I'm not saying don't go to your doctor, don't get it checked out, and don't give up on medications if that's what's recommended for you. That said, exercise has been shown in a number of studies to be as effective both as a preventive and a treatment for depression as medications. It turns out that exercise, again, through the same chemical, Miracle-Gro, BDNF, acts in the brain to work with another chemical called serotonin, which people have heard of, to reduce depression. And in animal studies, if they just inject straight BDNF into the rat's brain, the rats become less depressed. And you can actually tell if a rat or a mouse is depressed because if you put them in a little swimming pool with a maze in it, they give up. They can't. They just sort of collapse and hang on the edge. They get depressed. It's called learned helplessness. And that's kind of a model for human depression. And the evidence, again, is overpowering of how effective exercise is as a mood enhancer.
You know, I was diagnosed with stage one breast cancer in 2017. But, you know, I have a pretty good prognosis. And I'm part of a there's an organization where I live that puts on a lot of exercise programs for women who have had cancers. And one of them is boxing. So I box twice a week, which I can say is both a kind of resistance and a cardio and an aerobic exercise. And it also makes you think about, use your brain a lot as you go through your moves. So talk about cancer and exercise.
Well, I'm very impressed by your boxing. I think that's great. Yeah, exercise in general has a somewhat important effect in helping prevent cancer. Obviously, it's not a slam dunk or no one who exercises would ever get cancer. But one of the most powerful things that exercise can do for people who already have cancer is it helps reduce what people call cancer fatigue. Fatigue turns out to be the main complaint of people with cancer, more than pain in many cases. People just don't have the energy. Then that's sometimes from the cancer itself, and it's sometimes from all the treatment, the radiation, the chemo, and all that stuff really eat into a person's energy level. And low energy can also kind of overlap with depression. So exercise turns out to be a very useful way to combat that fatigue. And I've known personally a number of people with cancer, even late stage cancer, who have kind of forced themselves, one guy in particular, to walk 3 miles a day. And, you know, he had to nudge himself to do it, but he felt better afterwards and less tired. And that's a common finding among people with cancer. So it is a good thing to do. Also, psychologically, it can be kind of empowering and sort of anti-discouraging, which is also useful.
I understand also from your book and also from other sources that exercise has a preventive, can help to prevent recurrence of cancer.
The data is strongest for combating the exercise, the cancer-related fatigue. But yes, there are some studies that suggest exercise can help slow the progression of cancer. It's not totally clear how this might happen, but it may help to have something to do with weight control. There are some studies going on now to see why this would be, but it's sort of a work in progress. And interestingly, the research on exercise for people with cancer actually began in earnest when a group of nurses noticed that their patients who kept on exercising were doing better than the ones who weren't. So it's a shout out to nurses for observing this.
Now, a lot of us have heard about something called the microbiome, which is hugely important, as we understand, more and more important part of our bodies, which is our bacterial, all the good bacteria that help us do all kinds of things like digest and many, many more. I was surprised to find out from your book, Judy Foreman, from Exercise as Medicine, that exercise is actually good for the microbiome. How does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the microbiome has burst onto the scene in the last few years. And most of the studies so far have focused on diet as opposed to exercise. And just to pause on that for a minute, our Western diet with a lot of processed food and not that much fiber is really terrible for the microbiome. A healthier diet with more fiber and vegetables is really good. There was a great study where the researchers got Africans living in Africa and African Americans living in the States, and the ones in Africa had much healthier microbiomes. They ate a lot more fiber and much less processed food, whereas the Americans had the typical American diet, high in processed food. They got the people to switch diets, and sure enough, the people who switched to a high processed food diet, their microbiomes tanked, and the African Americans who switched to a more African diet with more fiber and vegetables and fruit, their microbiomes improved dramatically. So a lot of that is diet, but there is beginning to be research showing that independent of diet, exercise can also help your microbiome, especially in the gut, be more diverse, have a bigger array of beneficial bacteria. So it's kind of an emerging area of research, but it is very important. And it's kind of fascinating too. I mean, now the government has a whole microbiome project, and a lot of research is going into this.
So if you wanted to leave us with some of the major take-home messages of your book, what would they be? You want to sum them up for us?
Just do it. You know, make it a habit. Make exercise your default position. Make it non-negotiable. It's not something you do if you have time or if you feel like it. It's what you do unless some massive thing intervenes. You know, there was an interesting story in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago showing that people actually have more free time than they think. This was a study of more than 30,000 adults, and it accounted for every hour of the day, you know, hours spent at work, fixing dinner, doing the laundry, taking care of the kids, all the stuff that you don't have a choice about. But people still had 4 or 5 hours a day where they did make choices. Mostly they chose to sit around watching television, but there is room for a choice there, and you can add exercise. You can watch TV standing up or running around your living room. We have more time than we think, and we could use more of that time for exercise, and we'd all be much better off if we did.
And you also point out it doesn't necessarily take a lot of exercise. Maybe just as we go here, tell us about the high-intensity interval training, that you can do it as little as 10 seconds at the top, 20 seconds moderate, and 30 seconds for low intensity for only 15 minutes.
Yes, there's a lot of evidence on high-intensity exercise, which is also called high-intensity interval training, which is also called HIIT. And there are a number of different protocols that you can find on the web and in my book. But basically, you work really hard, sort of sub-maximal, but really hard. So you're definitely panting for, say, 30 seconds or a minute. Then you back off for another minute or two, walking slowly, or even just standing for 30 seconds and then walking slowly and then ramping up again, and doing it 4 or 5 times in one exercise period. And you can get a lot of the benefits, especially the cardio benefits, from this high intensity stuff. And it takes much less time. So for people who really feel that they just don't have the time, this is a way to use 20 minutes really effectively to get very large health benefits.
Well, that's terrific. And there is so much more in this wonderful book, Exercise as Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. Judy Foreman, it has been so enlightening to talk with you today.
Thank you, and good luck with the boxing.
Judy Foreman. Go to writersvoice.net to find a link to her blog, where she discusses many of the topics in her book, Exercise as Medicine. Next up, a terrific new novel that explores identity, exile, and even parallel worlds. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. And check out our Facebook page at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon and our Twitter feed at Writer's Voice. Michael Zapata's debut novel, The Lost Book of Adana Moreau, is a mesmerizing story of a Latin American science fiction writer and the lives her lost manuscript unites decades later in post-Katrina New Orleans. In 1929 in New Orleans, Adana Moreau is a Dominican immigrant who writes a science fiction novel that earns rave reviews, and then she begins a sequel. But she falls gravely ill, and just before she dies, Adana Moreau destroys the only copy of the manuscript. Decades later in Chicago, Saul Drower is cleaning out his dead grandfather's home when he discovers a mysterious manuscript written by Adana Moreau. He tracks down an address for her son in New Orleans and travels there just as Hurricane Katrina arrives. The Lost Book of Adana Moreau is a brilliantly layered masterpiece, and I highly recommend it to all my listeners. Well, Michael Zapata, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited.
The Lost Book of Adana Moreau, I hugely enjoyed it, and it was very thought-provoking as well. And the book moves back and forth in time to tell the story of another book that is the lost sequel to yet another book, its author and her son. It begins in 1916 with the invasion of the American Marines in the Dominican Republic. So tell us just a little bit about that story, why you start that there, who is this author, Adana Moreau, and then her son and his father, the last pirate of the New World.
You know, well, my family, my father's family is from Ecuador. So growing up in Chicago and hearing so many generational stories about America's involvement in South America was always something I not only constantly heard as a child growing up, the sort of oral tradition of being first generation and Latino in the United States, but also sort of the deep history of it. You know, there's so much from the 1970s, and the further back I dig, I just found sort of the interesting scope of American involvement in Latin America. And I don't know if I consciously so much chose the Dominican Republic. I have cousins who are Dominicanas. So I think it became this narrative that became entwined with thinking about New Orleans as the northernmost Latin American city. In the deep history of the French and the Spanish Empire, the deep history of smuggling, you know, pirates, freed or escaped slaves from New Orleans too, which sort of led to the trajectory of thinking about how all these became intertwined in the Caribbean. So Adana Moreau, you know, came to me more through her language and more thinking about this oral tradition through American history. And she just sort of emerged with this sense of there are so many Latinas, not only Latin American science fiction writers and novelists, but particularly Latinas who have been forgotten as far as the literary history of not only the American South, but also the Caribbean. And what emerged from that story was sort of the interconnections between the Caribbean, Latin American history, the Spanish Empire, and so much of that coalesced for me in thinking about the history of New Orleans as well. And so she marries a pirate. She marries a smuggler who was very much involved. There's this great tradition of hundreds of years of Afro-Caribbean smugglers and pirates who had found a sense or sort of freedom after slavery within the trade routes in the Caribbean. And so I really viewed it as this sort of colliding parallel worlds in the Caribbean, reaching all the way through New Orleans. In the story, they have a son, Maxwell Moreau, and I very much identified with him once I found that character because he is mixed like myself. I'm Lithuanian Jewish and first generation Latino, and even though I come from Chicago, there's this great tradition in places like Chicago or New Orleans where you suddenly find yourself as a mixed child in a society that may or may not have no place for you. Increasingly through history there is, but absolutely not in the 1920s and 30s in places like New Orleans. Although there's this wonderful, there's this wonderful like between two places where people can find each other and exist. And I really identified with Maxwell Moreau in that sense. So if I had to summarize all that, I would say for me, it became this colliding historical force with that found itself centered in New Orleans and the Caribbean.
Well, that was a very rich answer. And let's unpack it a little bit. First of all these influences are in the book. There are two stories of, first there's Maxwell, who is orphaned, like his mother. His mother is orphaned when the American Marines kill them when they come in 1916 to the Dominican Republic. So she, as you say, meets the last pirate of the New World, and she writes this wonderful science fiction novel called Lost City. And then there is another boy who is also orphaned, is raised by his grandfather, who comes from Lithuania. And these two stories entwine. Now, I don't want to give anything away, but I wonder if you could just give us an indication, an outline of how these two stories collide and create a new story.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I always kind of related towards, I think, being young and growing up. My family is Litvak, Lithuanian Jewish tradition, and my father, like I said, his family is from Ecuador. So it becomes for me in these, like I said, colliding parallel worlds. I've been trying to make sense out of these narratives that stretch back centuries. So in the novel, Saul Drower, who finds this mysterious manuscript that Adana Moreau has destroyed before her death, but he finds that the sequel, he's coming from this Lithuanian Jewish heritage, but his family, his mother and father had met in Chicago, and then they are killed, and he becomes orphaned in Israel. So he comes to the United States as sort of this exile, the same way the Dominican's child, Maxwell Moreau, does. And I became very interested in this concept of how are we orphaned through history, and what sort of catastrophic ruptures and time and space in history leave people abandoned. There's this great word in Spanish called desplazados, which essentially means displaced people. So we have this, of course, in America, this deep tradition of displaced persons showing up on our shores, many who are orphaned. And I think it becomes intrinsically not only part of sort of the greater American story, but it becomes this sort of continual historical narrative that reaches into, 2019. And I saw it while I was teaching in Chicago for some years. I was a high school public teacher for dropouts for 10 plus years. And I saw the effects of historical narratives that could reaching back a century, reaching back 50 years, or American involvement, for example, in the 1970s in South America, in my classroom immediately. So it became one of those deep, I don't want to say inspirations, but it became one of these deep influences where, as my students were exploring those stories and what they meant in their own lives, as I was researching the history of all the way reaching back to the Russian Civil War and Russian Revolution, and then, of course, considering all the American sort of historical involvements in Latin America, again, it became this, for me, this sort of colliding force pulled from my own life, pulled from history. And when I found myself not consciously planning to have that on paper, but I didn't know any other way it could go once I started writing.
And even then, you tie it in with the internal refugees now that we have with the climate emergency happening, because, and we should tell our listeners, we've gone forward in time. So it's back and forth in time between the early 20th century and then the early 21st century. Hurricane Katrina, where this mysterious manuscript is finally being returned, hopefully, to Maxwell, who was a child in the earlier time and then grew up to become a theoretical physicist and is now in his 80s and a refugee from Katrina. So you're tying these historical and contemporary catastrophes together to tell the story of America in some way.
You know, I always think about it in terms of looking at sort of the catastrophe, disaster, and tragedy of what happened with Hurricane Katrina, which is very much a human-made effect, not only through global climate change, but through sort of our increasing, dare I say, neoliberal economics in our country. And I always kind of thought about empire coming home. There's this strange thing that happens where there's no other place for empire to go in our modern world. There's no other place for sort of this hyper-capitalist outreach to go. So it comes home. And I think one of the first and most profound sort of canary in the coal mine situation for many, many Americans was what happened during Hurricane Katrina. I have been going to New Orleans my whole life since I turned 18. I have lived there with my family. So I saw those effects of empire coming home, not just the privatization of all of the wonderful public resources that were in New Orleans, but sort of the deep sense that in the United States, we should expect climate change refugees. That's a very common thing that we discussed. You know, there's Cli-Fi that is wonderfully explored in today's current climate. But I think after Katrina, it felt all relatively new and shocking to a lot of Americans, myself included.
Yes, yes. Myself included as well. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Michael Zapata about his debut novel, The Lost Book of Adonna Moreau. And the other theme is the one that weaves in and out. We've talked about being orphaned and exiled, but this theme of alternate universes. Maxwell grows up to be a leader in the field of theoretical physics of alternate universes. And his mother, Adonna Moreau, her great and successful first novel, Lost City, and then her second one, with the sequel, take place around this theme of alternate universes. So what's that about? What is it, a metaphor? Is it reality? Yeah. What is it for you?
I think it's such a wonderful question. I think the first way I think I tried to approach it is that, number one, it can be looked at sort of as this metaphor for those of us who are biracial in the United States and who are attempting to explore this quiet, this unclear, this sometimes lonely, often very beautiful place between two disparate cultures, or cultures that may not have as much overlap as we're aware of initially. I grew up biracial, and I grew up with so many first-generation Americans in the Chicago area, in Chicago, who were coming from places like Iraq, very close Assyrian friends who are like family to me, from India, surely from Latin America, fellow really close friends who were from Puerto Rico, Mexico, Colombia. And you're not only forced to explore as a first-generation American this new world, but you're also inhabiting and inheriting different worlds and different oral traditions from all the way across the globe. So I think as this process of thinking about identity, even when I was a child reading things like Isaac Asimov or sort of strange sort of essays in Scientific American about parallel universes, I was just initially magnetically attracted to that concept, and it only became more exciting to me when I started to research this actual theory behind it. I spent maybe too much time reading as much as I could about concepts of quantum physics and parallel worlds, and it seems to me on an almost mind-blowing level that this sort of next stage in theoretical physics involves seemingly an endless universe with endless possibilities, Now, as a fiction writer, one of the things I've also been thinking about a lot lately, and for sure during the course of writing this book, is if parallel universes do exist, what does that mean for our decisions on this one? Are we aware of the decisions we make, and are we aware of the manifold options that we might have? There's this great thing that my great-grandmother, who was a refugee herself from Lithuania and who I was really blessed to know until I was 13, she used to always call me a Luftmensch, which is, for listeners who aren't as familiar, it can mean somebody with their head in their clouds. But it can also mean, more poetically, a cloud of possibility. And I think as first-generation Americans or immigrants or refugees, we're sort of forced to think about clouds of possibilities and that deep question, what if? Yeah, through catastrophe and material struggle and exile, there's this constant question in immigrant families of what if? So I thought more upon the process by when I was reviewing the first draft that these were themes that were sort of emerging naturally, and I wanted the reader to experience sort of the deep sort of ethical and first generation and immigrant question of what if? How do we build the narrative that becomes our lives? And for me, the infrastructure of our lives often relates to that question, what if, which is deeply and mathematically related to parallel universes, and also, you know, definitely a metaphor for those of us who find us a little freshly on the shores of the United States.
Infrastructure of our lives? What do you mean by that?
So I fundamentally think that when you are an immigrant or when you're first generation, you're constantly forced to ask this question, what can my life be? And so the infrastructure, the ways in which we think about our own lives, is centered around that question, what if?
Now, also on page 79, I'm going to say you write, even though it's one of your characters says this, that the only real difference between one universe and another is merely a question of language. What do you mean by that?
Yes, that's thank you so much for stating that quote. I think it's related to what we have been discussing. Language is this just this enormously powerful thing that exists in our heads day to day and our lives. And when you are first generation, when you are an immigrant, it's this process by which you're not only accessing a new language, but you're sort of accessing the possibilities of it. You know, there's something I've always thought about when I read a neuroscience article as a teacher, that the ways in which we can potentially imagine our future are inherited from our experiences in the past. And so it becomes this sort of future tense, past tense relationship in which at the center of it, you're asking questions about where my life can go and what those sort of imagined futures might entail. And I think one of the most extraordinary things about being human is the ways in which we imagine the future primarily start through language.
Yeah, and I also thought of it another way, which is, you know, language implies story, and the different stories we tell ourselves about our lives can put us into alternate universes.
100%. Absolutely. And I think there's something very deep and ancestral sort of survival mode about that too, where we're a species for a million years who has managed to adapt quite well given sort of extreme circumstances. Going back to climate change, we've been able to do that, and sort of those imagined futures I think play a central role in our survival. So I absolutely agree with that sentiment.
Those of us who have a memory are able to live in that fragile space between past and future. Those of us who have none are already dead. And you write this in the context of writing about people who lost their family members during the Chilean dictatorship. So, as I said in the beginning, this is a thought-provoking book. I kind of puzzled over, what did you mean by that? When we don't have memory, we're already dead.
Yeah. The context of that for sure is there, and this was based on the true organization of women who had lost family members during Pinochet's just absolutely devastating and cruel dictatorship. Many of them had lost daughters and sons to the secret police, and Pinochet often would bury or disappear individuals either at sea or in the Atacama Desert, which is where these women go to search for the remains of their lost loved ones. And so there's this difficult point in which when you access memory, it's necessary to understand, of course, the present and who you are and what sort of relates to your language and makeup of who you want to be in the future. But it can also be a very, very tough place to only live in. And it doesn't necessarily prepare us for preventing for future catastrophes. There needs to be, I believe, at some point, whether it's politically or personally, that you are prepared to face what comes next, whether that is sort of a personal experience in mourning, or whether it becomes a political one. It's an extraordinary thing for me as far as Latin American history that the children and the grandchildren of those people in Chile and in Argentina who had faced dictatorships and dirty wars are the ones currently marching in the streets against privatization of schools, government agencies, who are forming, you know, these wonderful sort of across continent solidarities, because they have this memory from their parents. They have this sort of deeply ingrained memory of what could possibly be happened. And if we only remain in the past, or if we only remain in that sort of fragile space, we can't prepare for the future. And it's an extraordinary thing to me that Chileans and Argentinians, and I'm Ecuadorian, and we just had this extraordinary protesting, indigenous protesting of new government and sort of new privatization rules, that it goes back decades, it goes back centuries to this sense of like we need to inhabit these memories. But unless we do something with them in the present, then there is no hope for the future, I think. And I think what I hope to imply by saying that we are already dead, meaning, you know, the ghosts and the dead can't affect the future.
Yeah, and you also make reference in this book to, you know, our current, what do you call it? It's a hysterical reality show. Mm-hmm. You know, where the dread for the future, you know, has been marked for many, including myself, since the election of 2016. And just this past week, you know, what we had feared is, you know, really the ante has been upped considerably. So how do you prepare for the future for you as you survey this landscape we're in?
Such a good question. One of the most meaningful experiences in my life was teaching. I absolutely adore and love teaching, and I taught in Chicago dropouts for 10 years. These were students who had dropped out for any number of reasons, whether they were medical reasons or they were, you know, brilliant punk rock kids who like woke up at 16 and said, "I'm not going to a school that doesn't serve me," in the ways that it could. Recent refugees, just really across the board. And I started seeing, and this was even previously during the previous two administrations, in which everything was being amped up even then. I personally went through a political crisis when I saw that my students in the previous administration were being forced to hide from ICE, including this devastating story of a student I had whose mother, who was hiding out in a church here in Humboldt Park in Chicago, from ICE. And so the solidarities that my students and their families sort of built around that, bringing her food, keeping an eye on ICE, all this was, it feels in some way so ramped up, because I do think this has been, again, looking back at history and that fragile space between the future and history, for me, through those experiences and being first generation, we saw those things quite early in the previous two administrations. So it becomes this sort of logical succession that the current administration had been given these levers that initially amount to fascist policies, and all they had to do was pull those levers. And as far as thinking about it, as you know, my wife is a public school art teacher, and here in Chicago, we just went on strike against a mayor who essentially was implementing the very same neoliberal policies that the previous mayor did and that have been sort of like only expanding for the past 40 years. And there was so much difficulty and so much beauty in the solidarity between teachers. And, you know, many, many teachers like myself in Chicago are coming from first generation families, previously oppressed peoples. A lot of the teacher makeup in Chicago and across the country are women and first generation individuals and people of color. And so that solidarity in fighting these sort of exorbitant neoliberal policies is tough, but it's also one of the most beautiful experiences I believe anyone can take part in. And as far as finding solidarity across rows of people, across cultures, it's almost as if you find yourself in a position in which parallel universes are not only colliding, but they're building for that fight, because I do believe we have a continued fight on our hands.
Yeah, that's very beautiful. I mean, what you're saying is the way you prepare for the future is by finding others who are also fighting for justice.
Correct. Yes. And organizing around those principles that are meaningful, not only to communities, but to individuals. One of the most interesting things I've heard a political analysis here say in Chicago is that people find themselves through self-interest, in the sense that when we have these issues that are directly impacting our own lives, we're kind of put in positions where we have to choose to find others who are going through the same thing. So we find solidarity through all of our combined self-interest. And I think that that's a narrative that's not necessarily as told so much in you know, mainstream media. But I'm very proud, I've always been very proud to be a Chicagoan, in which that fight is ever present, not only in conversations at the dinner table, but on the street, and also in the very hard work of politically organizing people to connect their self-interests.
And not to put too fine a point on it, but also that solidarity encompasses the students, because they're not only supporting their teachers, but the teachers' demands very much have centered their students' needs.
Absolutely. It was just such a profound experience. And I had went through the strike here in 2012 as well, but it was a profound experience to see the support from those students and parents supporting teachers. And so I agree with you, at the forefront of all of this is always the students, which, connecting back to the novel, I think whether we're in the parts that explore the Atacama Desert or even the Argentine Great Depression, at the forefront of that is these forces of solidarity that seemingly can be pulled from disparate and different worlds. So I'm so glad to be talking about this with you, because it's something that is hard to, I think, hard to do and explore in a novel that is inherently non-political. I felt like I wasn't overtly making political messages in the novel, but I hope that readers do respond to those moments of solidarity that are throughout.
And it is a great novel, I would say. It's beautifully written, and it's a deeply evocative book, The Lost Book of Adanna Moreau. Michael Zapata, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you so much for inviting me on. It was such a joy to talk to you.
Michael Zapata is a founding editor of the award-winning Make Literary magazine, and he's the recipient of several literary awards. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.